It's great to see so many of you here. My name is Mike Savage. For those of you who don't know me, I'm director of the III, and I'm really pleased to chair today's seminar. Before I introduce Sam, I just want to quickly say we do have one final event of the term. Next Wednesday the 11th, as part of our seminar series on migration, ethnicity and race, we have Hannah Teager from the Methodology Department talking about role-playing racism, history teaching and the limits of experiential learning. That's next Wednesday, 1 o'clock to 2 o'clock. Okay, so it's a great pleasure to chair today's session, partly because I've worked with Sam Freeman a long time, and Sam is Associate Professor of Sociology. He's previously worked at the Universities of York, City University, with a PhD at Edinburgh. Initial studies were on the issue of comedy, stand-up comedy, and how comedy was part of a new motives distinction. But over the last few years, he's become very famous for his work on social mobility and taking forward the social mobility agenda. One of his many accolades is he is the only social scientist who is a social mobility commissioner. So he has a very exciting but also fraught role of trying to get public authorities interested in and engaged with social science research. And over the last few years, he's been working with Aaron Reeves on using new kinds of data to look at elites. And this paper today is a new paper that he and Aaron are working on. They're called Aristocratic Highbrow and Ordinary, Shifting Modes of Elite Distinction, 1897-2016. He'll talk about 40 minutes, 45 minutes, then we'll have about half an hour for a discussion.
Thank you very much, Mike.
We are filming. So if anyone doesn't want their photograph taken, sit at the back.
silent filming. Right. Just a few shots, and it won't disturb in any way. And
okay. Thank you, Mike. It's lovely to see many friendly faces here. Although slightly nerve-wracking not to do this with Aaron Reeves, who is my, as many of you know, my statistical better half, and he is on strike. Perhaps we should be as well, but sadly we're not. But please go easy on the technical questions without Aaron here. Now, in June of this year, as he vied for the Tory leadership, Boris Johnson was asked by an interviewer about his recreations. What does Boris Johnson like to do with his spare time? The answer might have been Greek literature, classical Latin, opera or fine art, all things we know Johnson enjoys based on countless second-hand accounts of his friends and biographers. But curiously, Johnson elided any of these highbrow passions and told the interviewer that his real passion was making model buses out of cardboard. A pointless piece of trivia, you might think, but I want to argue today that Boris's very public piece of cultural self-presentation helps us to unravel a pretty foundational sociological puzzle. And this is, namely, how do elites signal their superior social position or sense of distinction through consumption of and participation in particular forms of culture? And to answer this question, I'm going to draw not just on the stated recreations of Boris Johnson, but of 70,000 further entrants of Who's Who, a unique catalogue of the British elite published every year over the last 120 years. Now, over the years, many theorists have addressed this issue of elite distinction. But we argue that it's possible within this to identify two broad dominant theoretical models. First, evident in the work of Tarde, of Simmel, and particularly Veblen, is the concept of social emulation. Okay, this is premised on a fairly simple idea that people generally defer culturally to those socially superior to themselves, and therefore seek to imitate or emulate elites by adopting their cultural tastes and recreations. In response, elites engage in what Veblen called invidious distinction, okay, differentiating themselves by continually developing ever more expensive, ever more elaborate tastes that then guard against the emulation strategies of lower yet aspirational classes. And of course, key to distinction here are the inherent limits of emulating elites, okay, whose recreations both tend to carry very strong economic barriers to entry, and who also vigorously police attempts at mimicry. So you just have to think about the age-old image of the upwardly mobile nouveau riche, who continually reveal their origins through the mistakes they make in their execution of taste. The second main model of elite distinction, significantly more influential, I would argue, in contemporary sociology, is the Borgesian idea of misrecognition. Okay? Here people do not so much emulate elites or emulate elite culture as misrecognize as legitimate their categories of cultural perception and appreciation. Okay, so it's not that elites themselves are considered inherent cultural paragons, as in the emulation model, but instead that they have an ability to generate a widespread belief in the intrinsic or inherent value of their own tastes and recreations. And this is achieved, according to Bourdieu, by elites occupying certain pivotal positions in society, particularly within government, also in education and in culture, that then allow them to establish, impose, even institutionalize their own the legitimacy of their own forms of culture. Now, significantly, one important distinction between these strands concerns how elites actually realize their distinction from other social groups. So for Veblen, the pursuit of cultural distinction is a fairly intentional process. Okay, people largely accept the ascribed origins of class division, and therefore distinction and emulation are both fairly logical attempts to either maintain one's position or achieve upward mobility. In contrast, Bourdieu argued that his conception of elite distinction is mediated by the habitus, okay, and therefore not necessarily intentional or voluntaristic. Moreover, where emulation theory rests on the kind of a deference to elites, okay, whatever the contents of their culture, misrecognition instead emphasizes the ability of elites to mobilize, whether intentionally or not, a widespread consensus around the intrinsic value of their recreations. Despite these differences, though, in both theoretical models, there's a striking tendency towards generalization, okay, to offer theories that transcend time and place. But I think the empirical basis for those claims lags behind, particularly recent literature on elite distinction. Indeed, in recent years, some have questioned whether elite distinction is still taking place at all. Central here have been studies documenting the rise of what's often called the upper middle class cultural omnivore, okay, who eschews a purely highbrow cultural palate, instead happily grazes on both high and low forms of culture. And some have interpreted this as evidence that elites are no longer using culture to pursue distinction, whereas others have argued that omnivorousness simply represents a kind of evolution of misrecognition. Okay? Now it's about the selective consumption of legitimate popular culture. Okay? And this was some of my previous work about comedy was exploring this idea. The final interpretation takes a different tack. Okay? This work argues that omnivorousness does reflect a meaningful cultural shift, but it's one that reflects a wider meritocratic turn among elites, increasingly keen to play up their ordinariness, play up their normality. Think Boris and his model buses, particularly in public settings. While many scholars have critiqued theories of elite distinction then, I think this literature contains pretty limited empirical scope. So historical work on this topic has largely relied on secondary sources, while the kind of voluminous, never-ending, it seems, literature on the omnivore has been constrained by the fact that numerically, elites are simply too small to show up on the kinds of nationally representative surveys normally used to measure cultural consumption. So the reality, and our starting point in some ways, is that actually we know fairly little about the specific tastes of elites, how these may have changed over time, and the implications of potential shifts for these theories of elite distinction that I mentioned at the beginning. So in this paper we draw upon a unique data source, 120 years of data from Who's Who, a catalogue of the top 0.05% of the British population. Fairly consistently over time, it's taken that slice of the British population to move forward our understanding of these questions. I want to explain a bit more about who's who, because it's obviously key to this analysis. Who's who primary documents what you might call a positional elite, okay, in the sense that at least half of entrants are included automatically, okay, upon hitting a prominent occupational position. So members of parliament, peers, judges, ambassadors, FTSE 100 CEOs, poet laureates, fellows of the British Academy, among many others, are all included by virtue of their office. Okay? The other 50% are selected by a board of advisors. Okay? Now, this part has long been shrouded in mystery, this part of the process. We've tried in various ways to get further clarity on it. It's quite hard because it's in some ways, the publishers argue, is kind of key to its legitimacy, that this part is kept very secretive. We interviewed Katie McAdam, who's the head of yearbooks at Bloomsbury, who published the book and who also acts as the coordinator of this selection process. And she gave us some important bits of information. So the process is not influenced by any kind of political behaviour or intention-seeking. Entries can't be purchased, an important element, right? Because these sorts of books in other countries, particularly in the US, have been discredited on that basis. Instead, a long list is drawn up based on individuals who have recently achieved a kind of noteworthy professional appointment, okay, but aren't on this automatic list. And often, and she said to us here, who are thought to have had a sustained influence on British society. Okay. And the advisors then decide from this long list who's included. I think we would also argue that inclusion itself marks as a kind of a marker of consecration in its own right. Okay? It reflects, but also through the public profile of the book, actively then constructs this idea in British society that there is a widely recognised national elite. Importantly, there's also three reasons why it's a particularly interesting source for understanding elite culture. So it's the first source, as I mentioned, the only data source that we know of that is focused specifically on elites and provides data on cultural tastes and recreations. Second, this data is unusual because it's based on a free text question. Okay, so entrants are free to input whatever they like. This means responses are not sort of limited to the normal kind of seven or eight categories that you tend to get in surveys on cultural consumption. And finally, and I think this is a really important aspect, you know, this is a public document, okay, very much a public document. And so I would say we think of the expression of recreations here as not necessarily what elites do, but more powerfully an expression of how they perform or want to display their cultural selves in public. Now, we analyse the data using two different methods. The first is called kind of dictionary methods. And what we do there is identify the proportion of people born in a given cohort who report participating in a particular activity by directly counting the number of times certain terms are reported. We then look at the main trends among these commonly cited terms, identifying, as I will go on to show, three large clusters of recreations that share similar trajectories over time. So first, we observe the initial ascendancy, but also then fairly swift decline of what we call aristocratic culture. Okay, so as this figure shows, early entrants, these are birth cohorts here, and we're displaying entrants here according to the decades in which they turn 20, okay, when we know people's tastes tend to solidify. These early entrants show a high propensity for hunting, for shooting, fishing, sailing, yachting, rowing, and a whole range of horse-related activities. Horse riding, horse racing, polo, dressage, eventing, and also golf. Now, this aristocratic mode reflects the fact that throughout the... just to give you an example of what this looks like on a for an individual, and how it plays out in the book. This is the entry for Frederick Dobson Middleton, keeper of the crown jewels at the end of the 19th century, who tells us here that he enjoys hunting, shooting, out-of-door sports, and later life fond of walking. So you can see kind of what the data actually looks like that we're working with. Now, this aristocratic mode reflects the fact that throughout the 19th century, the foundations of elite social life in the UK were firmly laid in the country. So dominant groups would congregate at the landscapes, the estates of the landowning aristocracy, and take part in these particular activities like hunting, shooting, and fishing. These activities were also institutionalised via what was called the season. Okay, and this was a set of regularised events in the elite social calendar, which dominated the leisure time of both the aristocracy and the landed gentry, okay, and which required vast economic resources to take part in.
So what is behind the labour crisis in the aristocracy? What exactly is behind there? Is that just wartime?
I'm going to get to that. I'll get to that. Yeah.
Wouldn't a lot of entrants only enter it after their 30s?
Yeah. So we're using birth cohorts, and then we are, and then we're looking at age 20 in terms of from their birth. We're looking.
I see. Yep. So in 1950, you might ask a 50-year-old what their taste is, but you assign that to 1920.
Yeah. Exactly. Okay. So, as this question just next, we can also see here that as the figure shows, at the turn of the century, the dominance of this aristocratic culture begins to wane. Two processes, we argue, were central in understanding this decline. So, first, American and British industrialists who had amassed fortunes, often surpassing actually even the wealthiest landowners in the UK, gradually began, according to many of the historical sources we've looked to, buy their way into high society, okay, purchasing country estates, marrying the children of the landed gentry. Second, and alongside this, there was a series of economic and social shocks which weakened the position of the landed elite. So in particular, the cost of labour, combined with falling agricultural prices, left many of the great estates in this period bankrupt and forced many of the aristocratic families to sell off large sections of their land. So together, these factors led to a kind of reconfiguration of elite social life. The social and cultural centres of Britain moved away from the counties to the cities and London in particular. But while the hold of aristocratic culture waned at the end of the turn of the 20th century, around the same time in our data, we begin to see the increasing importance of highbrow cultural activities. So as you can see here, starting around 1920, before slowing down after 1950, we see a marked increase in preferences for theatre, for classical music, literature, opera, and the arts, particularly influential in understanding this decline, we argue, was a generation born between 1900 and 1929 who were heavily influenced by what we called the Bloomsbury Group intellectual collective. Okay, not necessarily everybody was in that, but they were highly influential at this period. So while this elite cohort had been often educated at the same sort of elite institutions as earlier generations, they were strongly critical of the kind of Philistinism of the leisured aristocratic culture that they saw before them. Instead, they embraced a set of emerging high, but also metropolitan cultural forms, abstract art, theatre, ballet, that were sort of promulgated by prominent Bloomsburys, okay, so Virginia Woolf, D.H. Lawrence, Roger Fry. But interestingly, the Bloomsburys were not snobs in the classic sort of exclusionary sense. In fact, their vision was that the elite should play a civilising role in society. Okay, they believed art had the ability to change the human character, and to do so, to bring about human flourishing, people needed to adopt the right approach, the right stance to culture. And increasingly, the Bloomsburys and others, okay, in this era began to kind of institutionalise this vision. In particular, they had an enormous influence on the ethos of a number of emerging cultural institutions of the time. And I could talk about lots here, the BBC, educational institutions, but just to give you one example, one of the most prominent Bloomsburys was the economist John Maynard Keynes, who was actually the first head of what is now known as the Arts Council in the UK, okay, the main public body that responsible for administering state funding to the arts in the UK. And interestingly, in this role, Keynes reduced support for local cultural activities and argued stridently that it was standards that mattered, okay, when it came to the state-sponsored culture, promotion of culture. One other interesting finding from this emerging highbrow period, the propensity of entrants to Who's Who actually reporting their recreations goes up very strongly during this period, from about 40% to 80% of entrants. So clearly then, as the institutionalisation of highbrow culture sort of gathers pace, so too the propensity of elites to express their own cultural recreations in public. But we see in the kind of third wrinkle in this data an intriguing break in the supremacy of highbrow culture in the 1950s and 60s. So the grey line here indicates that the proportion of entrants who express only highbrow recreations begins to fall in the 1950s. Okay, and historical accounts emphasise several factors. I'm not going to go through them all in detail here in explaining this. So you had shifts within the culture and creative industries which legitimise certain popular cultural forms. Okay, most prominently, perhaps, you think about rock music. Generational value change, which precipitated a sort of decline in snobbery and deference in Britain at the time. And also the emergence of a managerial culture where access to a kind of broad cultural repertoire was seen actually as a key management tool. But you can see this figure not only shows a move away from highbrow culture, it also shows from the 50s onwards a rise in preferences for more popular cultural forms, particularly football and cinema, as well as a set of kind of ordinary, everyday cultural practices. Spending time with family, friends, and pets becomes very prominent. And while these ordinary recreations may not be superseding the more conventional elite pursuits, their significance to our analysis is rooted more in their integration with traditionally dominant modes of culture. Let me explain that.
This is also from the Who's Who.
Yes. But to explain this kind of melding of cultural modes, I just should first say that one of the problems with dictionary methods that I've shown you so far is they kind of ignore the way entrants combine their recreations in this entry. Okay, they don't pick up on the expression of how the expression of one recreation might be intimately connected to a set of others. So to address this issue, we introduce a second method, okay, a semi-automated form of content analysis, where we begin first by initially hand-coding 600 entries, marking whether respondents report interests in these three categories, aristocratic, highbrow, ordinary, that we've already shown you. We then create categories which represent all possible combinations of these activities. So a respondent might blend both highbrow, the arts, with the everyday, spending time with family. And once completed, we plug these hand-coded entries into a machine learning algorithm, and then it reads the rest of the entries in and calculates the proportion of entries within a margin of error in each category. Okay. And we also validate this by hand-coding another 600 entries and seeing whether the algorithm predicts this second set of hand-coding, which it does quite accurately. And what this semi-automated content analysis shows us is not only fairly similar trends to those captured in the dictionary analysis, but interestingly, in terms of the everyday mode that I captured in the previous graph, what it shows us here is that actually the mode that is most increasingly moving upwards in recent cohorts involves actually combining this popular and cultural disposition with more traditional highbrow activities. So, in other words, the British elite appears to be becoming increasingly omnivorous. But as I mentioned in the introduction, the problem with this idea of omnivorousness is that it can be interpreted in many different ways. So, and obviously these are difficult to address in a sort of quantitative data set like we have here. But actually there's something interesting about the way people express their recreations in this document that can provide some clues. So many people, for example, in Who's Who choose to actively play with the form of their entry. Okay? So they don't just list activities, they describe their interest in a kind of knowing, ironic, humorous way. Okay, so you can see some salient examples here from sailing opera, gardening, perfecting espresso coffee, applying Wittgenstein, tennis, guitar, cycling, skipping, herb surfing, dendron, leaping, and my favourite, loud music, strong cider. Now, we argue, I suppose, that this kind of playing with the form indicates a kind of subtle act of distinction, okay, with entrants demonstrating their kind of aesthetic confidence to knowingly play with the form. And as we show here significantly, while such playing with the form of the entry is almost non-existent for most of the period, in most more recent cohorts, you get quite a steep take-up of people starting to do this. Of course, this is still a very low proportion of who's who entrants. So another way we were thinking, how might we get at this idea of what's going on in this elite omnivorousness, was to think about precisely what type of popular culture do elites like when they say fairly generic things in who's who, like music, okay? Huge amount of people just write music. How do we get at that? So what we did to address this was we introduced another form of data. So Aaron rather miraculously managed to convince the BBC to give us the entire archive of songs played on Desert Island Discs, okay? Which is, those of you that don't know, a radio show broadcast on the BBC since 1942. The format of the show is very straightforward. Each week a castaway, usually a noteworthy or influential elite person, is asked to choose 8 songs or pieces of music that they would take with them if they were stranded on a desert island. And as over 60% of the people that appeared on Desert Island Discs are also in Who's Who, we can merge the data sets to provide a more granular analysis of about 1,200 Who's Who entrants. So two interesting findings emerge from this. First, the analysis echoes the trend of omnivorousness, okay, that we can see more generally. So while early entrants almost exclusively play highbrow classical music on Desert Island Discs, after the 1960s, this shifts strongly. The majority, after that point, combine classical music with more popular musical genres. Second, we try to go a bit further and examine the legitimacy of the popular musical artists being played on Desert Island Discs. So what we do is try to analyse the average score that the artist has on the music website Metacritic, okay, which aggregates the reviews of albums. And what this demonstrates is that actually the artists played by Who's Who entrants are consistently more legitimate than average in terms of their mean Metacritic score. And they are consistently actually in the top quartile. So, takeaway point from this, I suppose, is that contemporary elites might be increasingly integrating popular culture into their recreational entries, but the individual artists they prefer still tend to tilt towards the consecrated. Finally, you might recall, though, from the main analysis that many of the non-highbrow recreations that emerge in the most recent cohorts are actually more everyday forms of cultural participation. They're not popular culture. They are things like spending time with family, friends, and pets. And interestingly, these things are not considered at all in normal sociological debates about cultural consumption. It's also striking, actually, that among the most recent entrants to Who's Who, it's these everyday sort of recreations that are rising most significantly, and much faster, actually, than the tastes for popular culture. So this final figure unpicks this rise to look at both cohort and period effects. So two patterns emerge here. Younger cohorts are far more likely to report these everyday recreations than older cohorts, but reporting also increases for all cohorts over time, okay, particularly among those who were added to Who's Who after 2000. Okay, so this suggests that the rising expression of these ordinary recreations, okay, these distinctly everyday things, is not just about the generation in which elites grew up in, but also the distinct period in which they enter Who's Who. Okay, and the distinct point in time which they're asked to present their cultural self in public. So I think there are in some ways, a sort of intriguing period effect here in terms of this foregrounding of ordinariness. Okay, there is lots and lots of limitations in doing this kind of work. I think it's important to be upfront about them. I don't have time to go through all of them. I'm sure lots of them will have already been clear to you as I've gone along. Just to talk about a couple. So we lack comparative data clearly on how at these points in history was the rest of the population. What was their tastes? We've tried to get at that by compiling some historical data on cultural consumption from different time points by other class groupings. And you can see that what we think we can see here is that certainly elites are quite distinct in terms of their preference for highbrow culture, which is what you can see in other data sets. So even among people in professional jobs, you can see that the rate of take up for highbrow activities is much higher. Second limitation is that our focus has here been all on sort of everyone within Who's Who. Okay? Surely that runs the risk of masking sort of heterogeneity within the elite. And the changes in the composition of Who's Who and how they might be driving our results. So we've looked at this in various technical ways, which Aaron would be able to explain much better than I would. There's actually a surprising degree of homogeneity sort of across potentially important subsamples by education, by occupation, by the mode of selection into Who's Who. But one important thing to note is that there are important differences between men and women. Women in earlier cohorts were far less likely to participate in aristocratic activities, but were far more likely to participate in highbrow activities. So you see in the data that men eventually catch up with women, but I think this suggests, and there's an interesting kind of story that potentially is there, that women may have acted as kind of first movers in relation to highbrow culture in the UK. But again, there's lots of wrinkles there that, about why that's hard to read off in a straightforward way. Okay. How long have I got, Mike?
2 minutes?
10 minutes, okay. So, just to reiterate, I'm just going to sort of move towards a kind of discussion of these results. What we think we've found here is three fairly distinct stages of elite culture in Britain. First, an aristocratic mode forged around the leisure possibilities afforded by landed estates. Second, a highbrow culture dominated by the fine arts. And third, this intriguing contemporary mode increasingly characterized by the blending of highbrow cultural pursuits with more everyday forms of cultural participation. And we want to argue, I suppose, that these shifts are not only are just sort of interesting in relation to changes in the nature and contents of elite culture, but they also underline two broad theoretical points about elite distinction. So to return to the concepts of emulation and misrecognition. It's worth saying, although these concepts were purported by their architects, Veblen and Bourdieu, to transcend time and space, I think our analysis indicates that actually their capacity to explain elite recreations in a UK context depends very much on the period you're examining. Okay? So in our first period, elites seem to be very much achieving distinction based on the scarcity of their aristocratic recreations and the emulation of others, okay, who largely in this period, I think, deferred to the inherent authority of those aristocratic tastes. But this model, premised on exclusivity, premised on deference, was threatened by the influx of nouveau riche industrialists at the end of the 19th century. And what followed was not just a new mode of highbrow culture, but also a new mode of elite distinction, premised on an unprecedented misrecognition of the inherent value of this new highbrow culture among the UK population as a whole. And centering, cultivating this were a set of elites who focused very squarely on institutionalizing the value of high culture, okay, via state subsidy, via educational curricula, which I haven't talked about much today, but is interesting, and about a critical discourse about culture that they were able to create as tastemakers in the media and other areas. So rather than sort of adjudicate between these two theories of elite distinction, we see evidence of both emulation and misrecognition operating at different points in British history. Okay. But perhaps more intriguingly, how do we make sense of this contemporary mode? How do we make sense of the contemporary recreations of the British elite? Well, our second point is that I think tentatively we think we are seeing a new mode of what we call ordinary elite distinction. Okay? And we would summarise this in the following way. First, it relies on the public display of some cultural forms of recreations that are and continue to be misrecognised as legitimate, be those highbrow or popular. However, such legitimate preferences are rarely articulated now in isolation. In fact, they are knowingly positioned alongside more everyday cultural practices, such as spending time with family and friends, that are, we would argue, largely unrelated to hierarchies of legitimacy. This combination, however, I think is quite distinct from previous interpretations of cultural omnivorousness, which often posit omnivorousness as indicating a kind of dissolution of cultural boundaries. Instead, our argument is that the expression of everyday cultural preferences performs actually a really important signalling function for elites. And this is partly about plugging a kind of authenticity insecurity that elites feel vis-a-vis the wider public. But we would argue that the pursuit of this authenticity is still ultimately connected to securing distinction. So as many studies in sociology demonstrate, non-elites, okay, particularly working class groups, often distinguish between elites who they see as decent and elites who they see as snobbish, with the former clearly valued over the latter. So it's not so much that elites are viewed with suspicion because they are elite, but rather it's their perceived smugness, elitism, and contemptuousness for others that rouses negative suspicions among other groups. In this way, it's possible to see the public expression of everyday preferences as a means of kind of accentuating cultural connection, of accentuating ordinariness. Again, think Boris and his model buses again. While at the same time retaining the cultural differences traditionally tied to the distinction. So in other words, the careful manufacture of ordinary self-presentation is effective in securing distinction because it means that actual cultural boundaries that continue to exist between elite and others are not questioned, as those in lower class positions no longer see the highbrow elements of the elite taste palette as status-seeking. One further, perhaps, speculative point is worth making here. So our analysis indicates that this ordinary mode of elite distinction, marked by these twin pursuits of distinction and ordinariness, is actually most clear from the 1990s onwards. And this coincides fairly neatly with the pulling away of the top 1% of the income distribution. Now, of course, this is only an association. It's unlikely that all entrants in Who's Who are in that 1%. But we would speculate that these things may be plausibly connected. Put simply, as elites have pulled away economically from other groups, there's evidence that they have become increasingly insecure about their moral legitimacy, okay? And increasingly sensitive to public concern that they are only motivated by extrinsic rewards, status, and wealth. So in this context, the connotations of ordinariness that accompany practices such as spending time with family, friends, etc., may act as actually a very effective means of shoring up moral legitimacy and signalling authenticity in an era of rising inequality. Thank you.
So shall we take questions at Bachelor 3?
I can try.
Yeah. Who would like to pick up with some Neil?
Yeah, thanks very much. Very interesting. So I think you alluded to this one point, and it's maybe more of a mechanical question. So things change over time,
yeah.
And particularly pastimes change over time.
Yeah.
So you can spend a lot more time in computer games today, much more than you could in the 1950s. Football has completely changed as a pastime over the past century. So we think that everything you've shown, perhaps it would be interesting to compare it relative to what it's relative proportion is in the population, right? And therefore, there you get a sense of, well, relative to everyone else, how much horse riding appears in Who's Who. And then I wonder what the patterns would be, because, I don't know, every time I'm in a, you know, waiting room and I pick up Tatler, it does seem that the lifestyles of these elites are quite different from my lifestyle, for example. So it's. I think if you can control for time, I wonder would that change the trend?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a key limitation here, and we tried, as I said, to get at it a little bit in terms of looking at, well, what are some other sources that give us a sense of what the rest of the UK was doing at various points in time. And you've got some quantitative data. This is studies. There was a mass observation study done in the 70s that looked at tastes. There's we're comparing that to what work that Mike did in the culture class distinction study. And I suppose it's very hard to do it in a sort of full way. I think what this is showing is that there's a distinctive sort of highbrow bent, there's a distinctive elite proclivity for highbrow forms of culture that supersedes the rest of the population. There's also, interestingly, in the qualitative work that we looked at, signs that there was in the mass observation study that was done in the mid-60s, I believe, the qualitative component, much more deference among the population as a whole to highbrow culture. Much more of a sense of a sort of belief in its, a misrecognition of its inherent value than you get, for instance, in the work that, the qualitative work that Mike and colleagues did in class culture distinction, which has you have quite a lot of testimony, don't you, about people in working class positions kind of saying, you know, we don't recognise that this stuff is high value. So there's something there, but of course there's going to be limits to how much we can sort of get that. Thanks.
Right. Yes, in the back. Yeah.
Thank you very much. Very interesting. Talk. I wonder, to what extent this is a story of the changing base, a social base of the elite itself, because you almost position it as a kind of juxtapose, the aristocracy followed by the influx of the nouveau riche.
Yep.
I wonder whether, you know, the rise of the kind of professional class from, you know, 60s, 70s onwards, which has a very wide social base, whether that plays any role. So you mentioned British Academy fellows as kind of featuring in that dictionary, but you know they're academics, and you know we are academics. We know we don't come from hereditary aristocracy, so the social base is quite wide. And whether that's really part of the story.
Yeah. So this, I think, is a really good point, and it kind of folds into this bigger issue about how these trends might be being driven by changes in the composition of who's who. So we do quite a lot to try and look at that. And, you know, you do see important shifts in the occupational makeup of who's who. It's never been something that's dominated by the aristocracy, for example. And I suppose there's something nice in about the fact that the most of those occupational, automatic occupational positions are actually very long-standing positions, historically. And so people essentially are getting into Who's Who by just hitting that point at various points in, over the last 100 years. There's a kind of there's a sort of a way in which that stays fairly constant. We have looked at whether or not done various fancy things, which I won't try and explain because I'll get it wrong, sort of counterfactual analyses and other technical ways to see whether the shifts we see in terms of the main cultural modes are affected by these changes in the composition of who's who along various axes, including different occupational domains. You do see, for example, that there is changes in the proclivity to like certain types of recreations by occupation. So, as you might expect, the military much higher at all points in history on this sort of aristocratic culture. But the trends across time among those groups is all fairly constant. So they all sort of rise and fall in these ways across occupations.
Okay, I think you're
I'm trying to understand, are you using elite as a kind of one-on-one interpretation or relationship with who's who? Elite and who's who? I mean, and the reason I'm asking is that one can perceive everything that you've done is very interesting for who's who,
mm-hmm.
but the organic composition of the two does have an intersected area, but they are kind of, they can be conceived as different, and somewhat different, but maybe it's, the intersection area is quite large. I mean, if you really look at the three cohorts over the century, the first one I saw from the activities was very outdoors oriented, hunting, fishing, horse riding, etc. And the last one also kind of converged to that first one. I mean, it's also very outdoorsy, I mean, hiking, walking, sea surfing, etc. And in the middle, I see, and that is, I agree with it, I see more, I don't know, intellectual, book reading, visiting museums, and so I'm kind of wondering if the last group, which seems to me that the occupations are acceptable in that cohort, but can they be really identified as elite? And why would you do so? I mean, I can alternatively think, alternatively I can think that the professional population has gone mundane. They don't read, they don't, I mean, for example, Castoriadis, this French philosopher, he has said that now we have really reached an age of insignificance. No one reads, all of these characteristics. So you can say elite has become insignificant from a philosophical point of view. Or you really need to define this elite. I mean, who's who is probably kind of has to be expanded or intensified a bit. That's what my feelings are.
Yeah, so this is, so if I can, so it sounds like the main question here is about is who's who a legitimate measure of the British elite? And this is obviously a key question. And it's a tough one because the concept of an elite is obviously, you know, point you to 10, 20 books about, you know, different formulations of how you would formulate that. I suppose we're sort of, we see this as a in terms of identifying a consistent source over time that has a certain legitimacy within British society and has been consistently used in academic research, for example, as, you know, the catalogue of the British elite, as well as various interesting external ways in which it's been validated. In the during the Second World War, Winston Churchill personally intervened to ensure its circulation was not affected by the paper shortage. He saw its importance to be, it was of national importance. So you see these, and you know, you see various ways in which it's been sort of externally legitimated, but of course you're always going to get this haggling over whether its selections represent what we might think conceptually as being the elite. I think what we're doing, so we have a project now that's ongoing on this. Aaron is very lucky, fortunate to get an ERC grant. So we're going to be looking at this in a lot more depth. And I think probably one of the things we will try and do is try and identify an elite within an elite, I suppose, within who's who. There are, I think, some groups that are less well understood, less well covered in who's who than you might think of as wanting to be in elites otherwise, particularly some forms of economic elite. But I think the thing that always interested us about who's who is that it really, its legitimacy, its reason for being, is that it's supposed to cover this entire sort of swathe of the British population in terms of the top layer. And I suppose it's based on a sort of Mildred occupational, positional elite in terms of theoretically. Yeah.
Paul?
Yeah.
I wonder if this highlighting ordinariness has something to do with meritocracy.
Yep.
So the idea there is that not just we are trying to kind of show how close you are to regular people, but rather to highlight what precisely the difference is, right? So instead of you being born into some upper class echelon and there that way in the elite, you're like everyone else, except the distinction is you're really great at something, and that's how you got into who's who, right? So it's kind of, it's not to remove difference, but to kind of show where the difference really is, and that's the thing we care about, which is merit.
Yeah, that's really, I mean, I think that's partly what we're trying to get at here, but that's really nicely articulated, I think, in the sense of why you seek connection, why you seek ordinariness, in order to then allow them what you feel to be distinctive in a meritocratic sense about yourself, sort of shine. It's also interesting, though, because I suppose in the past, and this was the point I was trying to get at in terms of the entrance proclivity for reporting recreations going way up during this highbrow period, is I think what you got was a period whereby elites felt in the middle of the 20th century that this was actually very much part of their merit. Part of their merit was being highbrow, that it was something to be cultivated and invested in, and then publicly performed very clearly as a way of showing your sophistication. And that is then subsequently critiqued. But I think that's it's an interesting element of how that's changed over time. And yeah, but thanks for that.
Yeah,
just to follow up, really. So there's a little bit of a tension, right, between sort of whether we regard this as a document containing the justifications or the sort of acceptable presentations of character and such, right, expressed through the activities and hobbies here by the elite, or whether we think of it as a document of what their lives actually look like, right? And I just wonder if you think it's sort of it's a mixture of the two, or if you're leaning toward one or the other.
So I suppose inevitably we're trying to tilt that to our advantage, but I do genuinely think that there's a really interesting methodological issue about the fact that distinction in a Borgesian sense is sort of inherently interactional, and is to some extent about display and the notion of how it's capitalized being something dynamic, but that most of the forms of data that we have are something that are captured anonymously, and that don't have any of that display aspect. And that's, I think, something that's really interesting here about what you're getting. It's sort of, I think for us, it's sort of a vantage point from which you can understand elite distinction as a sort of communicative process. But I think at the same time, it in terms of trying to read it onto whether it's what elites actually do or not, you sort of have this interesting methodological effect whereby perhaps you foreground the more honourable aspects of your self-presentation in this sort of public document, or you curate your recreations in a way that present yourself in an admirable light. And I suppose lots of the work that I've done in the past qualitatively would sort of say that actually when you get behind those, people are much more snobbish, much more judgmental. But that's a sort of, there's a methodological issue about where you see that and where you don't. And yeah.
Any non-male questions? Yeah.
Thank you very much. That was really interesting. Given that you have these unique data sets, I'm pretty sure that there's nothing comparable for other countries. But I was wondering that particularly this shift from towards this ordinariness,
yes,
is something that we can observe also in other countries,
yes,
and whether you have some insights on that.
Yeah, so actually there are, this ERC project is going to be linking up with two or three teams in other countries that have got similar Who's Who data. They're all slightly different, They're all, you know, they're all sort of institutions in themselves that have got distinct histories in terms of why people are selected and why they're not, but the function within their individual societies are quite similar. So we have the Danish, the Norwegian, and the French, who's who. But none of them has data on recreations. So this is a quirk, a fascinating quirk, which might be an interesting point about the role of culture in a British context compared to other countries, that this is the only one where people, where it's seen as an important part of the biography of an elite person that you would include your recreation.
I've got a few. the popular culture graph, where it shows it going up in the late 90s, did you find out whether those are new entrants or just people shifting their culture? Could you explain a bit more about the everyday recreation culture? Is that distinctive to elites? And do you think that the change to this is harming or improving social mobility?
Okay. Yeah, thank you. Those are great. So, who only details recreations? What we can see in the data is the last year that a person provided data. So there is this sense that it neglects possible changes that have occurred over the life course. So what we did to explore that was we hand-coded recreations for two versions of the book, one that was collected in 1988 and then the most recent version, to see whether, you know, the version that we've got that's just got the last entries of each one. If you look at some of the people who were putting their tastes down in 1988, is there a change in then what they've put in 2016? There's actually very little change. So people are very rarely changing their entries. Of course, they may well be changing their recreations in real life, but whether they change them in the book or not, it's not there. The second question was about explaining the ordinary recreations better.
If you explain it perfectly, it'll just be maybe recreation, like spending time with your family. Is that a popular culture that other people do as well, or how is it?
Yeah, so that's a really good question. So in terms of what one of the things that we tried to look at was we looked at time use research, which does capture sort of particularly the stuff about spending time with friends and family. To again see this point that Neil raised about, you know, how do these things relate to the rest of the population? And the interesting point is that the time use research, and this was from Jonathan Gershoni's recent Pelican book, that the amount that people in general in the UK are spending with family hasn't really changed in that period. And yet in this document, elites are saying, I'm not saying they are spending more time with friends and family, but then they're saying that they're spending time with friends and family much more. I think that's quite significant because it kind of points to the fact that it's not just the fact that there's a kind of cultural shift in general in Britain where, you know, people are spending more time with family. And then the thing about social mobility. Yeah, I mean, that's really interesting in this. I haven't really thought about that, but I think what's interesting, I suppose, here is that this gives the illusion that possibly cultural assimilation into the elite is easier because the sort of stark boundaries that might be linked to early socialisation in a bourgeoisian sense in terms of the inculcation of the aesthetic disposition and highbrow culture has been undermined. But I think that's where I would really focus on this fact about the, you know, desert island discs data, that there's still very clear nuances in what's the right popular culture to like, and that those are still linked in a bourgeoisian sense to what he would call the aesthetic disposition. So the way of seeing culture and the way of talking about culture still being something that's very linked to class background in terms of how it's inculcated. And therefore, you know, if I think to the class ceiling work that I've just done, you know, it's very clearly still one of the big barriers for upwardly mobile people trying to make it at the top of elite firms in the UK
is that they are sort of both their anxiety and other people and incumbents' snobbery about their performance of their cultural selves, you know, and it's playing out in, you know, the moments before a meeting starts when people are chatting about what they've done over the weekend, those sorts of seemingly banal moments that are actually very important for governing a sense of who fits.
Yeah, I just had a question on heterogeneity and just a few ideas of things that you might have looked at or might have planned to look at. And first of all, professional difference, which comes back to the question about meritocracy and so on. So some fields, you know, probably more meritocratic than others or have different ideas about what they want to represent in terms of meritocracy and whether that changes the kind of things they're going to advertise about what they're doing with that spare time. I'd be really interested to know whether, like, the boom in kind of people becoming very rich through finance, for example, there must be a change of composition of the who's who elite in terms of, you know, shifting weight of different sectors and so on in the economy. So I don't know if you've thought about that already and if you have any preliminary results. The other question would be, I mean, I can't remember exactly what's in these entries, but presumably there are like associational affiliations as well, right?
Mm.
Which club you're in,
and so on.
That's been a big thing in the beginning. So I'm just wondering, individual level like affiliations might be a really interesting thing to explore as well, because again, as well as denoting certain types of activities, they might also suggest like networks which might lead people to represent themselves in different ways.
Yeah, so I mean, so there's quite a big part in the written paper trying to deal with these very obvious points about heterogeneity generally and therefore differences by subgroup, but also how shifts in the composition may then affect the results. The big story is that all sorts of tests, we do all sorts of sort of robustness checks along those lines, and they don't really show a huge amount. What you do see, as I say, is that you do see differences in the intensity of the take-up of particular modes by occupational group. As I said, the military much more likely to be aristocratic throughout history, but the changes over time are fairly consistent across professional groups. So you see the same rise and fall of the aristocratic just from a higher base among the military. The one that I mentioned that's a bit more meaningful, I think, is the gender issue. As I sort of alluded to, there is this, you know, point about essentially misogyny, that the women who are in the earlier entrants, the earlier editions of Who's who are, you know, there's very few women, you know, are they representative of the elite women that should have been in Who's Who at that time, but were basically excluded for reasons of, you know, sexism, and if those, you know, so I suppose in our, what we're seeing is that the women in Who's Who in those periods take up highbrow culture much more readily and earlier than the men. But is that because there are some fields that women in that earlier period could get into Who's Who from? Classic, you know, one being something like literature, which is occupationally something you might then expect to be linked to highbrow taste. So the other sorts of elite women who should have been in Who's Who and later were in Who's Who by virtue of a sort of professional achievement, you know, what would happen if they were in that, they were in that period? Would we see that effect in the same way? So the point about composition is really that heterogeneity doesn't seem to affect the overall storyline. There are a few interesting wrinkles around intensity and around gender.
And thank you, really interesting data set. One of the categories that I would have expected but didn't come up in the activities described by the elite is something that has to do with like domestic versus worldliness. So something that is very UK focused versus something that is more outward looking. I was wondering if that is packed in among highbrow activities and if that's something that could be teased out a bit more, because I find that to be quite critical if we are trying to understand maybe
how parochial the British elite is, basically.
And if that has changed over time with urbanization, it does seem like the very metropolitan style of consuming culture has
I think certainly the highbrow in terms of where those
you know, where the Bloomsburys were taking inspiration from in terms of the sort of, you know, the art that they were putting on a pedestal, and then trying to put it forth as this is the best that culture can produce, was often outside of the UK. Often inside the UK, but often outside the UK. So I think that's probably the shift. And then it's much harder to see that in the most recent data, I think, in the sense that it sort of perhaps needs more specificity. It's, for example, something interesting we could look at in the Desert Island Discs, where you have this much more granular data about musical taste. So you could see, you know, proportion of foreign musical artists versus domestic. So that would be something interesting to look at. Yeah. Thanks.
One last question, perhaps. Yep.
I'm just wondering what elite distinction looks like in more economically equal countries, and maybe with more equal education systems as well.
Yeah, good question. I think that the interesting point that our colleagues in Norway would point to as an example of that is that to some extent cultural capital almost takes on a more powerful differentiating capacity in more economically equal countries. But I'm certainly not an expert on that. I can point to lots of Scandinavian critical literature that would sort of make that point, that there's this kind of puzzle as to why class cultural differences are really striking in Nordic countries, even though economically they're more equal. And I think it sort of, it, to some extent, and this is a kind of theoretical point, I suppose it speaks to, you know, the sort of structuring force of distinction and why people need it and how, and that economic equality doesn't always take away that inclination. But yeah, it's probably beyond my expertise a bit.
Okay, I think we should move on, finish. Thanks to Sam for a great presentation and a really exciting data set and analysis. So thanks again.